This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday, December 14, 2012. In Kansas City, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up, protesters rally in Egypt ahead of tomorrow's vote on a draft constitution critics say gives too much power to the military and Islamic religious institutions. Michigan lawmakers pass what some women's rights groups are calling the most restrictive abortion measures in the nation. And a federal judge rules that Oakland's police department won't be taken over after leaders agree to a compliance director to oversee reforms. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. A mass shooting at a school in Connecticut this morning has left at least 27 people dead, including more than a dozen children. Reports are changing constantly, but it appears a gunman entered a Newtown elementary school and opened fire first in a kindergarten classroom. Media report the shooter is dead. The U.S. has agreed to send two batteries of Patriot missiles to the Turkey-Syria border. Last week, NATO approved what they called defensive measures for Turkey. Defense Secretary Leon Panetta justified the decision after signing the deployment order.
So that we can help Turkey have the kind of missile defense it may very well need in dealing with threats that come out of Syria.
Along with the missiles, the U.S. will deploy 400 troops to the border to operate the batteries. Germany and the Netherlands have also agreed to send Patriot missiles to the country. House Republican authorized spending to defend the Defense of Marriage Act is now close to $2 million. Congressional Quarterly reported yesterday that the GOP signed off on a $500,000 increase in the legal contract with a private firm in September, unbeknownst to Democrats and the public. The original contract was set at $500,000, but Republicans have increased the maximum twice now. In a statement, Minority Leader Nancy Pelosi chastised Republicans for hiding the contract from voters and wasting taxpayer dollars to defend an indefensible law. Security personnel with two contractors at John F. Kennedy International Airport in New York have voted to walk out ahead of the holiday travel rush if their demands for higher pay and union recognition are not met. FSRN's Peter Rue has more.
100 employees with the security contractor Global Elite voted today to go on strike. On Thursday, security personnel with AirServe considered the same measure. Prince Jackson announced the results of the AirServe vote during a rally at JFK's Terminal 3.
AirServe workers have voted to authorize a strike.
Yeah! Both sets of personnel, totaling 300 employees, are seeking union recognition and a living wage. They also want further training and basic equipment, such as radios, to improve passenger safety. Jackson has been with AirServe for 3 years. Despite working 40 hours a week, he says his $8 hourly wage doesn't leave him enough to pay the bills.
I personally can't afford groceries. My salary is just enough for me to pay my rent and pay for my transportation costs, my clothes to be clean. After that, I really don't have any money.
If progress on negotiations is not made, passengers can expect travel disruptions at JFK starting December 20th. Peter Rue, FSRN, Far Rockaway, Queens.
Three North Carolina death row inmates were resentenced to life in prison without parole Thursday after a judge found there was evidence that racial discrimination in jury selection played a role in their sentences. Attorney Ken Rose with the Center for Death Penalty Litigation says with numerous statistics showing this kind of racial bias, the state should consider automatically converting the sentences rather than going through the expense of lengthy trials.
If we have race discrimination in almost all of these cases, we have a uniform remedy, and that is that those persons are taken off of death row and given life sentences.
This is the second ruling under the state's 2009 Racial Justice Act. Olympia, Washington activist Maddie Pfeiffer is scheduled to go before a federal grand jury today. He's the fourth Pacific Northwest anarchist to be subpoenaed. The records are sealed, but it's widely believed the government is investigating property damage to a federal building during May Day protests in Seattle this year. Like his fellow activists, Pfeiffer has vowed to refuse to testify and expects to be jailed. The administration at Virginia's Hampton-Sidney Men's College has suspended one student and disciplined three others for their involvement in a violent anti-Obama election night protest outside the minority student union on campus. Students threw bottles and shouted racial slurs. An incident review committee is looking into a similar protest that happened at Ole Miss University. Their report is expected by the end of the year. Native American activist Leonard Peltier has been in prison for 37 years, convicted of aiding and abetting the murder of two FBI agents on the Pine Ridge Reservation in South Dakota in 1975. Over the years, activists have continued to lobby for Peltier's release, and tonight, high-profile musicians are coming together in Manhattan to raise awareness of the case. FSRN's Melinda Tuhus reports.
In the mid-1970s, the Pine Ridge Reservation was the murder capital of America, as traditionalists and their allies in the American Indian Movement battled the Indian government supported by the U.S. After two FBI agents were killed in a firefight at Point Blank Range, Leonard Peltier fled to Canada and was extradited to stand trial. He was convicted and sentenced to two consecutive life terms, even though the prosecutor has since admitted the government has no idea who shot the agents. The concert, hosted by Pete Seeger and Harry Belafonte, features Jackson Brown, Danny Glover, and many more. They are pressing once again for clemency. Peltier, who's 68, is in poor health, but friends say still hopeful that he won't die in prison. Melinda Tuhus, FSRN.
And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in Kansas City. In cities across Egypt, supporters and opponents of President Mohamed Morsi have held final rallies ahead of tomorrow's referendum on a draft constitution. Mohamed El Baradei, the former UN diplomat and coordinator of the opposition National Salvation Front, has said this document belongs in the garbage bin of history. President Morsi says the measures in this constitution are necessary for a democratic transition, but has given the army temporary powers to arrest civilians to ensure a peaceful vote. For more, we go to Khaled Fahmy, chair of the History Department at the American University in Cairo. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Nice to talk to you.
You've said that the referendum is being conducted in an extremely divisive atmosphere. Tell us about the situation on the ground in your area of Cairo on the eve of this vote.
Well, there are demonstrations and counter-demonstrations in Cairo, but also elsewhere. I think the fiercest clashes today have happened in Alexandria as a result of some of the sheikhs of the Indus Friday sermon asking the congregation to vote for yes, which is something that those who believed in the no vote got enraged by and thought this is a blatant intervention of religion and politics, and they had a fight in the mosque. And that also happened in the south of the country, in Nagar Hammadi. So throughout the country today, no fatalities, but very serious confrontations between the yeas and the noes.
What parts of the constitution are Egyptians particularly concerned about?
It's not only parts of the constitution, but the way in which it has been drawn. This is a constitution in which the constituent assembly that has drafted it has not a single Coptic member. Egypt's religious minority, Christian minority, have not been represented. Very few women. The clauses that protect women are very weak or non-existent. The clauses that protect youth, religious minorities. There are many clauses that give significant powers to the president. Of course, in some respects, it's a considerable improvement over the previous constitution, but this is why we had a revolution after all. So basically, people say that this is it falls way short, far short than what we had hoped for after launching our revolution. And judges in Egypt are supposed to supervise the process of voting in order to guarantee a degree of impartiality. And about 75% of Egypt's judges have decided to boycott and not to supervise the process.
As you mentioned there, judges, also journalists and opposition political groups have had serious problems with how this document has been drafted. Can you tell us a little bit more about what also concerns them about its contents?
There are many things, many aspects, but there are two areas in particular that I personally find problematic. One has to do with the military and the other has to do with religion. With regards to the military, we had hoped that the new constitution would curb the power of the military in politics. And specifically, we wanted the constitution to specify that the Minister of Defense will be a civilian, and or the parliament will have a supervisory role over the budget of the military, and also to stop the process of presenting civilians to military tribunals. The constitution has none of this. It specifies very clearly that the Minister of Defense has to be a military man from among the officers of the army. It established a supreme national council for defense. The majority of its members are military rather than civilians, and it alone has the exclusive right to discuss the budget of the military. And lastly, it also, in another article, gave military tribunals the right to try civilians in case civilians enter into a skirmish with the military. All of these things are things we had objected to. With regards to religion, the Constitution added two articles that I find very problematic and many people find very problematic. It retained the original article, the famous Article 2 in the previous Constitution that says that the principles of Islamic Sharia are the main source of legislation. So that is okay. There is no contestation about this. We kind of reluctantly accepted this to stay in place. However, it added two articles. One of them is to allow Al-Azhar, which is the 1,000-year-old religious university seminary establishment in Egypt, to have a say in interpreting Sharia. And then added another article, Article 219, defining what Sharia is, and it defined it in very classical doctrinal manner. The fear is that now we have two bodies in the Constitution itself, the Supreme Constitutional Court and Al-Azhar, that compete together on interpreting the Constitution. And I think this is a very serious breach in the very edifice of the Egyptian legal and constitutional system.
You've mentioned the many judges who are boycotting the vote. Are other opposition groups boycotting the referendum? And does it need a minimum turnout to be a valid vote?
No, there's no minimum turnout. It's a 50% plus one. There has been calls to boycott, and the National Salvation Front, which is a coalition of opposition groups, did not announce its official position except a couple of days ago when it said that, no, we are not going to boycott, we're going to go and vote no, provided that there are some stipulations, some conditions of the process of the vote. As far as I know, these conditions have not been met, but the Salvation Front is not revising its call for people to actually go and vote no. I personally expect a high turnout tomorrow. It's very difficult to know. Of course, the airwaves and the independent TV channels and Facebook and Twitter are abuzz with all kinds of predictions and polls, but it's very difficult to know which direction the country is going.
Khaled Fahami, Chair of the History Department at the American University in Cairo. Thanks very much for talking with Free Speech Radio News.
My pleasure.
Less than 24 hours before a mass shooting took the lives of children and adults at a Connecticut school, the Michigan State Legislature approved a bill to allow concealed weapons in gun-free zones, such as university dorms, classrooms, and sports stadiums. In a marathon late-night session, state lawmakers also passed what some women's rights groups are calling the most restrictive abortion measures in the nation. The bill, which Governor Snyder is expected to sign, would force women to pay to have an aborted fetus buried by a funeral home, make doctors comply with expensive new regulations, and make reproductive care less available to women in rural and underserved areas. Yet, as Michigan and some other states move to make abortion access more difficult, some on the political left and right are calling for reducing abortions by improving access to birth control. FSRN's Alice Olstein reports.
Michigan's active lame duck session continued into early Friday morning when the Republican majority followed up passage of anti-union and previously struck down emergency manager laws with a bill to restrict reproductive rights. With protesters locked out of the Capitol building, House Bill 5711 passed the Michigan legislature 72-35 around 2 a.m. In a speech on the House floor, Democrat Lisa Brown blasted her Republican colleagues for pushing the same bill that inspired massive protests earlier this year.
Thousands of people stood outside of this building in June in opposition to this legislation. Who are your constituents? I am no longer flattered that you are interested in my vagina. I'm offended and disgusted. Your obsession is disgusting. Move on and move the state forward.
Among other provisions, the bill will make all women who have to terminate a pregnancy after 10 weeks, even from a miscarriage, pay for the fetus to be buried or cremated by a funeral home. Another provision requires all abortion clinics to comply with the same strict building requirements as outpatient surgical centers.
Clinics in this state have been providing safe abortion care there for decades, and this is nothing more than an attempt to shut them down.
That's attorney Amanda Allen with the National Institute for Reproductive Health. She said that on top of the bills passed this week, which she called extreme, there may be more on the horizon.
The legislature is also considering several measures that will ban the insurance coverage for abortion in the state, and that's through both the state's health care exchange and in private insurance plans.
During last night's debate, Michigan Democratic Representative Jeff Irwin accused those pushing these bills of misleading voters.
We've heard all week that black is white, up is down, union busing is good for unions, and now we're going to hear in a moment that reducing women's rights is good for women. This is nonsense. It's doublespeak. It's wrong. You need to stop it.
But not everyone in the GOP sides with the Michigan lawmakers. One of the country's most high-profile and outspoken Republicans, Louisiana Governor Bobby Jindal, has come out in support of making birth control available over-the-counter. In an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal, he argued that providing over-the-counter contraception would allow women access to the choices they deserve without requiring employers providing insurance to, quote, violate their religious beliefs. Just a few weeks ago, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists announced a similar position, saying it would help address the major public health problem of unintended pregnancies. But the organization emphasized that steps must be taken to make birth control affordable for low-income women if it's sold over-the-counter, since it would no longer be fully covered by insurance under the Affordable Care Act. Alice Holstein, FSRN, Washington.
It's been more than 6 weeks since Superstorm Sandy tore through the Mid-Atlantic region, leaving millions without power and tens of thousands homeless. While life in some affected areas has returned to normal, other places continue to struggle. FSRN's Jessel Knorr reports on how one community in Brooklyn has demanded accountability and had some of their demands met.
Cheryl Braxton has lived in the Red Hook Housing Projects, Brooklyn's largest, for four decades. Walking down Bay Street, which was under 6 feet of water, she points out where Sandy hit the neighborhood hard.
To my right is the tall projects in the back, where all the lights and water and hot water heat and everything went out. I'm going to walk toward where the rest of Sandy had flooded, which is where I live at.
Many people lost heat, power, and water after the storm, and the Red Cross and FEMA took days to arrive.
It sent a message to us that they didn't care about people who live in public housing. You know, I felt that I was not counted.
Tenant Elisa Pizarro works at the Red Hook Initiative, a community organization that became a central hub for relief efforts. Local residents, community organizations, and Occupy activists provided food, water, and medical supplies for thousands of tenants. Now, they're pressing for answers from the New York City Housing Authority about the pace of current recovery and what changes need to be made to prevent a similar catastrophe in the future.
So they need to, you know, look at the what they have, for, you know, in case and, you know, damages like that when a storm hits, and then think about the people that live in those places and don't have those people wait, you know, weeks before they get their power up, water. I mean, we couldn't do our essentials, like take showers. We couldn't even flush the toilets.
The Housing Authority repeatedly refused to answer FSRN's questions concerning allegations of slow disaster relief and recovery, but did respond in a statement saying they are working hard to restore electrical and heating systems damaged by the storm.
I'm going to be honest. If you would be without electricity, I can't really answer that question. Unless you go through it, then you know how it feels.
Residents like Isaac Gill have also had to appeal to the city to provide immediate rent credits and suspend evictions. The Housing Authority initially refused and instead offered a rent credit for January 2013. But that wouldn't help Gill and many other low-income residents who lost jobs and income due to the storm.
I've been 2 weeks without electricity. I have a 76-year-old mother that no phone. Verizon has not put on our phone to this date. And I can't go out the house. I got to stay in there with my moms. I lost my job due to the storm.
After several meetings with the Housing Authority and a rally at the agency's headquarters, officials said they would suspend evictions until January 1st. Residents were still not satisfied and pushed officials until they agreed to extend that date to February 1st. But Braxton says there's still plenty residents are not happy about, including ongoing power, heat, and hot water outages caused by the continued use of generators housed in large outdoor trailers.
To my right is a boiler. That's what we're actually, we're getting heat, hot water, and from these boilers on the side, which are temporary boilers. Soon we're supposed to get permanent boilers.
Braxton and other residents are meeting with Housing Authority officials again Friday. They want answers on when utilities will be fully restored and why FEMA was slow to respond to residents. They also have concerns about potentially contaminated water supplies and chemical residue washed up from the flooding. Braxton says they may also demand building repairs the Housing Authority has long neglected.
We're going to have other meetings with them to actually see how the progress goes with what they're saying. So they're working with us. There's still more issues to be actually discussed.
Recovery is also underway in hard-hit Staten Island and the Rockaways, where residents and Occupy activists are holding action Saturday, calling for public infrastructure that supports the people. Organizers plan a citywide convergence at Mayor Michael Bloomberg's residence in Manhattan to demand the city do more for Sandy survivors. Jessel Knorr, FSRN, New York.
In Oakland, California, a federal judge has ruled against putting the police department under federal receivership. Instead, a court-appointed compliance director will oversee Oakland's police department for a minimum of 1 year, or until the department implements reforms meant to correct and prevent abuses of power. The decision comes after more than a decade of foot-dragging by the Oakland Police Department, following the landmark Oakland Riders case, which exposed widespread corruption and complicity in the department, police watchdog groups say. From Oakland, FSRN's Park Lowe has the story.
In 2000, more than 100 people testified that they were victims of police brutality and had been set up by four corrupt cops, known as the Oakland Rough Riders. Civil rights lawyer John Burris filed a class action suit against the police over the riders' incidents.
The worst part of that whole deal, once it was uncovered, not one supervisor or command person was ever held accountable.
In 2003, the city settled by paying out more than $10 million to 119 plaintiffs. It also agreed to make 51 key reforms, 10 of which remain unfulfilled. That's what led federal judge Thelton Henderson, who was overseeing the riders' case, to threaten the city with a federal takeover of the police department. Last week, Judge Henderson ordered Oakland's mayor and police chief to meet. Both parties conceded that the city could hire a court-appointed compliance director who would implement the long-overdue changes. On Wednesday, Henderson approved the agreement. It's not a receivership in name, but the effect is similar, according to Burris. He drafted the proposal.
It's a de facto receivership from our perspective, meaning that the person who is selected to be the compliance director will, like a receiver, report directly to the judge and would have the responsibility of directing the department through his or her own evaluations, development of new policies and procedures that are designed to get the department into compliance within the next year.
In the years since the rioters' scandal, Oakland has remained plagued by police misconduct. 8 out of a total of 9 men shot by Oakland police during the last 2.5 years were black, including 37-year-old Derek Jones, who was shot and killed near his barbershop in 2010. The year before, 22-year-old Oscar Grant III was shot and killed by a BART police officer. Another controversial case involves the killing of 18-year-old Alan Bluford last May. Bluford's friends, who were present at the scene, say that Oakland police officer Miguel Masso chased and shot Bluford. They said Bluford was unarmed. Officer Masso said that Bluford threatened him with a gun. Bluford's father, Adam, says the incident was tragic, but not a surprise.
The community in Oakland, where I was born and raised, more or less have no trust for the police department and their brutality. They feel like it's ongoing in the department. This is what they do, and they're going to say it's justified and it's normal procedures.
Bluford says Officer Masso violated several procedures on the day he shot Allen.
An initial stop was never called in. That's against policy. When he chased my son a half a mile, he never called the chase in. And he had his lapel camera on, and it was off at the time of my son's murder.
Some of those procedures were reforms mandated by the rioters' settlement. The city and police did not return FSRN's request for interviews, but last May, Deputy Captain Sean Wendt told FSRN the department was making progress in reaching compliance on needed reforms. Burris is cautiously optimistic that instituting a compliance director, who will have the power to fire the police chief and other command staff, could change the department's internal culture of impunity. But some activists, including Oakland-based Malcolm X grassroots movement organizer Sanyaka Bryant, say government oversight is not enough. Bryant has been door-knocking in East and West Oakland to invite people to neighborhood tribunals, large meetings where people, including some who have experienced police violence, document their stories and come up with ideas about how to affect change.
Ultimately, the police need to be under the control of the people. Directly, organized body of community needs to be in control of the hiring, the firing of the police. It shouldn't be like the police review boards that we have now that don't have any teeth.
The Malcolm X grassroots movement works with survivors of police violence, including the Bluford family and their supporters. Recently, Adam Bluford took a trip to the East Coast to spread the word about the injustice of his son's killing.
I'm preparing to go nationwide with this fight for justice. I mean, we can't bring my son Alan back. What we're trying to do is have somewhere where citizens to come when they've been brutalized and have nowhere else to go.
Bluford wants the police department to fire Officer Masso, and he wants an end to stop-and-frisk police practices, which he said is responsible for why his son was initially detained. Puck Lowe, FSRN, Oakland, California.
And that's it for today's program and for the week. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Janine Etter. Our theme music was composed and produced for FSRN by Alan Weatherhead. We welcome your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. Thanks for listening. In Kansas City, standing in for Dorian Marina, who'll be back next week, I'm Danny Wood.